What do I usually do at the beginning of the show?
We already heard the intro?
No, we did not hear the intro.
Ah.
Wait, here it is.
Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
That's Greg.
Interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Let's fade that down quick since we're starting, slightly late. I don't know. It's kind of normal for this show. It just takes me a while to set up after the last show gets out of here. If you read the Facebook feed or look, I don't even know if it logged on the site yet, but I promised a new friend, blogger, known as Esoterics. Hey, can we use your actual name on the air? Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, it's just that I haven't turned off. That's how we fade that one. There we are. Okay, here we go. That's better. This is what editing was invented for. So yes, we can use your name, right?
Absolutely.
All right. This is Aaron. Can we use your last name? Oh, how do you pronounce your last name?
My last name's Daba.
And The way I found out about Aaron's writing was that Bruce Duensing, who was our guest, about three shows ago, posted one of your essays, the Down the Rabbit Hole essay, which seemed entirely appropriate to what's been going on in this show recently. You said you listened to the Bruce Duensing episode, right?
Yeah, I listened to a lot of your recent stuff, and I could see the connection.
Yeah, it's for a while people were complaining that all that shows like mine were doing were complaining about how horrible everything was. So I've tried to stop complaining and find people who are doing, thinking, and saying things a little differently, or at least in ways that most people don't talk about, that seem to be either fruitful or at least interesting to me because it's my show. So that's why I asked Aaron on. Who agreed immediately. Sometimes there's people I call up, they're like, oh, I don't know, I've never been on the radio. Have you?
I'm a radio virgin, so be gentle.
Oh, okay. Well, you don't sound like it yet. The blog is called Esoterics. You write as Esoterics, Esoterx. I don't know, you want to do the normal thing to start with? It's like, why? Why are you even doing this? Why are you even interested? Because I talked to you the other day, and we realized, like a lot of people we know, we were interested from an early age. So did that just manifest, or did something like set it off?
Well, I usually tell people that I was raised in Chicago, and if you know Chicago politics, the dead can vote there, and
yes,
that tends to give you a certain perspective on otherworldliness that starts at an early age, and I was raised at a time, I was my academic pursuits happened at a time that I was in grad school doing anthropology, when there was a real tension in the field between whether anthropology should be a natural science or a more interpretive field. And they use fancy terms that sound somewhat threatening, like Geisteswissenschaften versus Naturwissenschaften, and those sorts of theoretical perspectives. But the simple fact is that you would have departments breaking almost in two, into people who felt that there was more that we should be a natural science versus a science of the spirit, as some describe it.
Huh.
The at that time, of course, I was also reading a lot of the big names in Strange Phenomena. I was reading Morning of the Magicians and Passport to Magonia and John Keel and all the big names. And it's Robert Anton Wilson, and you and I talked about that a little bit as well. And it really is very detrimental to taking things at their face value in the social sciences. If you're simultaneously reading Althusser and Adorno and learning about post-colonialism and things like that, and also learning about the tensions between whether a field should be science or shouldn't be a science, and then reading some of the strangest things you can imagine. And the truth is, I've always been interested in strange phenomena, obviously, but I've tended more away from the standard UFOs. UFOs, people see stuff in the sky, right? Don't know what it is. It's unidentified. Great. You know, Bigfoot, remnant Neanderthals, ghosts. Who knows what it is? But they're not so implausible if you're willing to suspend disbelief. What I like are...
Or belief, probably.
Yeah, true. What I like are the absolutely absurd things out there in the universe. I find them much more appealing and much more interesting. The famous toad in the hole, you know, they find the rocks with... they've been buried for a few hundred thousand years and there's a live toad in it. And,
yeah.
I remember a story that I read in a letter, and a little bit of disclosure. I was an office boy for a magazine that did some strange phenomena stuff. So
we'll
I got to read a lot
that.
Of letters.
Yeah.
And the one of the stories that just stuck with me was that an alien, extraterrestrials land, usual UFO contact sort of story, a young babysitter in charge of a kid, alien ship lands in the front yard. The alien comes into the house, doesn't say anything, walks to the refrigerator, takes out a Dr. Pepper, and leaves. And just the stories that you can hear, the details sometimes are just so bizarre that it makes you believe in an absurd universe. And that a lot of the things we tell ourselves are the fear and anxiety of the possibility that we live in this in an absurd universe.
Yeah, well, the reason that I got interested immediately was basically the theme. That you're basically talking about your Down the Rabbit Hole essay that was your most recent one, I think, in many ways. And you know what got me about that was what you just said. It's like, yeah, so what? It's weird. It is weird. It shows you that there's something that doesn't fit on the map here. So maybe we ought to expand the map or change it or. Thinking there is one.
Absolutely. Even Charles Fort threw up his hand sometimes. I remember he had once a story that stuck with me. I think it was a cat appeared in Louisiana on the street, turned to a crowd of people, said, "Hot, isn't it?" Or it was either that or "Hot enough for you," and then disappeared in a puff of smoke. And he had he said, "Look, I don't have any explanation for this. Yeah. I'm not even going to try." I mean, it makes no sense. There were lots of witnesses, and that, you know, he threw up his hands and said, I don't know. I don't know what it means.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
But that's the thing, is that something being absurd, I mean that in the sense, the sense of absurdism, the style of Albert Camus, that, you know, you can assume that the universe is meaningless,
yeah,
but that shouldn't preclude the search for meaning. That's the important part.
But what is the meaning of a cat? Well, that's what, I guess that's what we're sitting here trying to figure out. What's the meaning of a cat that turns, that appears and tells every, asks everybody if they, if it's hot enough for him? Well, I mean, absolutely. I guess we have to make some sense of it somehow, especially if it happened to you.
Yeah, well, the search for the meaning is the important part. It's not, or at least this was the feeling of some of the absurd, the absurdist philosophers, was that you reject existentialism because you're not going to reach that point where you've discovered that that important fact about the human condition that that resolves everything for you.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean you have to treat everything nihilistically. I mean, right. Not everything matters, but not everything is unimportant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The funny thing is when you say that, I think the part of the meaning in it is kind of self-referential. It's so ridiculously stupid, some of these things, and so not on the map that becomes the meaning of it. It has nothing to do with our survival, really. It doesn't really do anything. Ultimately, a lot of these weird things don't really threaten anybody's existence, but they might threaten their thinking about existence.
It's true. I wonder if perhaps civilization in general is based on pretending that things don't exist. It's an important component. And the reason I say that is, watch Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom or the National Geographic Channel or something like that. Animals are terrified. Everybody looks at meerkats popping up and standing on their hind legs and thinks how cute they are. They're terrified. they're watching for anything that can come and eat them.
Yeah, they're vigilant.
Yeah, which suggests that, like most animals, the think the world is a big, scary place, and it's at best indifferent, and it's probably wants you dead. And I think, in a lot of ways, civilization makes you forget that certain things exist and certain things don't exist. I mean, it's why you have things like you write down the commandments. You're hoping that eventually people will think those things don't exist anymore.
Writing down? What do you mean writing down the command? Oh, but that it never happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that you didn't have to worry about that you never did covet your neighbor's stuff or his wife. Or, that was a remnant of the past, and it's a rejection of the idea that there is anything to be scared of. And I wonder if we're I don't want to sound like I think everything is meaningless. It's simply and a good example of this is these days people look at reality TV and they say, oh well, it's not real. And the truth is, it's not real. Some of it's scripted, some of it's manufactured, but it says something about human beings, and that's the meaning that we should be looking for.
Yeah, but for anything, I mean, just even for this stuff we're talking about, the weird stuff. What does it mean to be human and experience these things we're experiencing? And as you said, it seems like there's. Are you implying, at least to me, it seems like there's. The less external stimulation there is, as in the middle of a city like I am, the less you're going to see the absurd unless you're finely tuned to it, I think.
Yeah, it's simply not as prominent. It's not on the radar. I think you're right. I think it's just not part of your day-to-day life. And I think in large part...
Bigfoot doesn't show up downtown.
Yeah. But there's huge numbers of people, and I discovered this, well, I didn't discover it, my wife is one of them, who don't care at all about this stuff.
Yes, I think that's most people, in general.
Yeah, and sometimes it's good to have people like that in your life that are grounding. I mean, you realize, this is all well and good, but, got to pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
Got to take the kids to school, that kind of thing. So it sometimes I think... there's a desire within the anomalous community to sort of filter out any fact that isn't respectable.
Yeah.
And it which is interesting because I think another trend that's happening is anomalistics, Fortiana, strange phenomena, UFOs, all these things have now sort of been moved off into a ghetto of weird news.
Yes.
The global, you know, weird news. And weird news is such a strange area. Because you look at all the major websites that are getting millions of hits and things like that and do weird news. It's stupid human tricks.
Yeah.
It's people doing bizarre cosmetic surgery and, you know, just things that even the grand old organ of strange phenomena, the Fortean Times, before it went behind its paywall, you could go there and you'd look at the news briefs. You know, they'd have a daily or every other day or so, a set of big news stories.
Yeah.
And over time, they increasingly simply became this weird news, you know, funny stuff, not odd, not anomalistic in the sense that we would think of it, but just here's something dumb that a person did.
Yeah, well, that's the clickbait, not the talking cat so much.
Yeah, well, and it's very easy to dismiss a talking cat, but a lot of this stuff is so, it's well documented, and I do a lot of research into historical stories. It's more my area of interest. I don't want to be eaten, like wandering around in a dark forest somewhere. But you read things like there's the famous Kentucky meat shower. Have you heard about that?
I've heard of meat showers all over the world. I mean, that's a staple of Fortean.
Absolutely. But it happened in Kentucky, I believe, sometime in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And
didn't people eat it and it was actually pretty good?
Yeah, and that's the strangest part about it is their first thought wasn't, you know, what fresh hell is this? It was, what does it taste like? which I found bizarre. And then the news reports were even better because they said some Kentucky gentlemen decided to taste it and assured us it was venison. And that they made the side comment, and I guess they were, you know, newspapers then were as snarky as they are today, several Kentucky gentlemen who are undoubtedly familiar with raw meat. I found an odd comment.
Yeah, well, there's also been rains of meat that apparently was human tissue, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, which and then I can't remember how they figured that out, but.
What I like sometimes is that the scientific explanation is often as convoluted as the Fortean explanation. Gnostic was the favorite that I saw a lot. I don't know how many people out there have been doing any reading on cyanobacteria, but that was a popular a popular explanation. Star jellies.
Okay. I thought not the stuff that was living on the cyanide compounds. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know what it lives on, but some kind of cyanobacteria that forms filaments and.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay,
it swells up and it looks and people think it's fallen. It looks a little bit like flesh and
yeah,
it's wonderful stuff. But I mean, there's just the lists go on and on. One of my favorite ones is. Exorcisms that were reported starting in the Middle Ages where the demons were correcting the priest's Latin grammar. I thought that was hilarious.
fanboys arguing over comic books or just being snarky. I mean, that's even funnier.
Well, it's proofread your contract if you're going to sell your soul. They seem to care about it.
Exactly. Why should we even listen to you? You can't even speak proper Latin.
Exactly. It's just the things that are more absurd, and you can kind of look at them two ways. It's why would somebody make up that detail if they wanted you to believe it?
That's what you can say about a lot of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another good one that I remember reading a letter about was somebody who saw a Grim Reaper middle of the night. I could go into endless details about it, but a Grim Reaper in the middle of the night, guy in a black hood, runs down the street. But the strange thing is he's wearing skis or what look like big skis on his feet, runs up to somebody's door, jumps up and down three times. And of course, that person turns out to have died in the middle of the night after the Grim Reaper has disappeared. And it's a detail that is just so odd and told with such reluctance that it really starts to make you believe in a universe that is just messing with us.
Or, well, I think if you listen to any of my shows recently, in the last couple of years, I think there's a lot of us messing with ourselves, too.
It's true, but some of that's us playing the odds, you know?
Yeah.
Can
you imagine how weird it really was as opposed to the person's memory of it?
Oh, absolutely. But, there's certainly the reason, a lot of sociologists and anthropologists say that we have monsters is because, you know, we're warning ourselves about things not to do. I mean, that's the most basic explanation of them. And, you know, I think you can take that one step further and say, well, maybe some of this stuff happens. And, you know, don't be a drunk teenager on a back road in West Virginia at 10 p.m. on a Wednesday night. You're going to see a UFO or a monster or something like that. Or don't rename the SS Amazon to the Mary Celeste. You know, it's a bad idea.
Makes no real wonderful – it makes no real sense at all in any practical way. But maybe that's the message. An absurd message for an absurd situation.
Yeah, and it's something that I run into when I'm talking to people about this sometimes. And I don't talk to a lot of people about this, or the ones I talk to quickly run in the other direction. But
eyes glaze over.
Yeah, it's absolutely. But the point of that is that, you know, you got – let's say you have 12 clowns in a circus ring and some new guy enters and stands in the middle of the ring and starts reciting Shakespeare. Everybody's still going to think he's a clown. And that's,
you're
going
to hook on to the first thing that makes you feel good and then just hold on to that thing no matter what weirdness happens.
Absolutely. So a lot of times I've tried to go for a sort of satiric, social commentary is part of my researching and looking into this stuff, kind of a la Ambrose Bierce, and more often I end up with something a little more neurotic like Woody Allen. But
yeah, you say that. It's so funny. I see that in the writing. Having read, I think I read about 6 or 8 different of your essays. And the weird thing about reading your essays is and the reason I wanted to have you on is that you were saying things that I think I've been thinking or have been in the back of my mind, but brought up to the front and said in a much more coherent way than I think I could have, or at least that I could have on a good day. And I started off with that essay, you know, the down the rabbit hole essay.
Mm-hmm. You're making me blush now.
Oh, well, I'm not going to have somebody on the show that I'm not interested in. I get people saying, why don't you have this person on? Why don't you have this person on? And a lot of the time, yeah, it's interesting. And sometimes people write me and say, I have this book. You want to have me on? And I look at what they've written. It's like, I have no interest in that whatsoever. And I'm not a money-making proposition. I am not the show is not a vehicle to get people famous or anything like that. It's basically to expose ideas. And I guess the people that have them, that's my favorite thing when there's not really an ego involved with it, and we're just talking about the thing. Not like
that's
kind of
why I like blogging is because I started doing it because I had things that I wanted to say, things that bothered me, things that I found interesting or curious or strange enough to share, and a particular take on them. And you know, it was nice to be able to say whatever I want. it's a good medium for that, and I think it wasn't exactly a labor of love. It was more like a labor of neurosis.
What isn't? What that's worth anything isn't.
It's true.
Or that's what it becomes.
I try not to jump too much into sort of the nastier parts of the arguments that you hear about, you know, science versus nominalistics and skepticism versus belief and weird news versus, you know, I try the old Las Vegas cocktail waitress maxim that don't get down on anybody else's hustle. But sometimes there's such a level of
I like
either
that.
Disdain from people who superficially seem like they should have the same sort of curiousness and I find that puzzling.
No, well, it's egos. That's one thing I said that recently, at least, and I said, what should be done with the UFO thing or paranormal things or ghost hunting or anything? Get the damn egos out of it. Make everything as anomalous as anomalous. Yeah, it's already anomalous. As anonymous as possible and anomalous as possible. Because I think what you're saying there is just people, they're saying kind of, look at me. And we're all doing that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if there's something interesting, somebody's adding something to the conversation, they can go ahead and they're saying look at me by bringing something to the table. And you know, your blog does that, and everybody I've had on the show does that. I think they do it for me anyway.
Well, it's funny, I wrestled a lot with whether the blog should simply remain this anonymous thing, and it's funny. At one point, the anomalous mentioned me in a tweet, just, you know, a quick thing as a wise man in the same breath as Lauren Coleman and Micah Hanks. And I actually got scared and hid under my desk for a few days because I figured literally I was doomed because I expected that people would want me to adhere to some sort of professional standard.
Oh, nobody cares. In fact, if you adhere to a professional standard, you're automatically not interesting to me. Adhering to an intellectual and curiosity standard, yes, but a professional, what is a professional standard with all this stuff? There isn't one. The professional standard is to keep your mind open and explore. You know, that's the professional standard.
I think so. I mean, I'm constitutionally incapable of acting professional for extended periods of time. So
good for you.
I mean, I try, I fake it. You know, you got to have the day job and all that. But which is interesting because what I do in my day job actually has a lot to do with this. Technically, my job is I'm an ontologist for a big internet company, and most people ask immediately, "What the heck is that?"
What the heck is that? I could make a guess, but what do you say it is?
Well, it's largely about classifying information, how to classify information, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of things that get written on the internet every day, and classify them more precisely so that you can do things with them beyond keyword search them. And it involves taxonomy and ontology, which is basically you're deciding what exists in the universe and how to identify it. And what you quickly learn as you're building taxonomies with millions and millions of entities and thousands of subjects and things like that is there is so much overlap and such a web of relationships out there that it becomes difficult to say that categorization is an absolute thing, which is why I think one of the problems in anomalistics is we want to definitely categorize this event was a UFO sighting or it was a ghost sighting. And when you actually try to do that in a universe of information, of millions upon millions upon millions of words and sentences that are produced every day, it's a task that it's simply never ending. You have to keep taking in data and taking in more data and building relationships between things that are not necessarily obvious.
Yeah, and you're actively doing that all the time? Because I'm sure that changes from day to day and hour to hour, and these are not hard and fast rules for a lot of things.
Oh, absolutely. Day to day, I'm helping build the systems that take in this data, make the relationships, link them, and I work with a whole crew of librarians that's put together subject taxonomies and come up with the sorts of relationships we want to identify.
You're trying to make a Dewey decimal system for the internet.
Essentially, but
sort of. I mean, in a loose definition.
For all intents and purposes, that's definitely what we're doing. It's a much more robust means for classifying things out there on the internet.
Okay. Yeah, because when I used to go ahead.
That leads me into where, you know, once you realize that categorization is such an enormous problem and you face it day to day, you start seeing it everywhere. You start seeing how things have been categorized historically, things traditionally. I've made lots of sort of offhand, I don't want to say nasty, but disdainful comments about ancient alien theory. And it's not that I don't think they have a really cool set of facts that they've assembled. It's a brilliant narrative.
Yeah.
It's just that it's assembling ideas that are anachronistic. They, you know, these ideas that they're ascribing to people 300 years ago are not necessarily ideas that they would have had in their heads. And these people also weren't morons.
Yeah.
Just because they, you know, they, a good example of this, there's a lot of stories about flying ships in Ireland. I think it was 8th century in Ulster. Somebody cited, it wasn't Reverend Kirk, the guy who does the fairies, but somebody cited a ship. And, of course, that has gotten lumped into the whole UFO theme, and it's often cited as, well, like, people were seeing UFOs back then, except that somebody dropped an anchor from the ship,
yes,
and it crashed the church. And to me, that says, well, you know, they may not have had a concept of a UFO, but they sure knew what a ship was, and they sure knew what an anchor was.
Yeah, didn't it hook the steeple of the church or something like that?
Yeah, that's a story.
And somebody had to crawl down the anchor to unhook it from the steeple of the church.
Yeah, and I think they beat him to death or something. But
like those guys in France that landed when the balloon landed in the 17 whatever unmanned balloon landed out in a field, and all these farmers came out and attacked and killed it or thought were killing it. And when they cut it open, all this horrible smelling stuff came out. So they thought it was some kind of strange, scary air monster.
Well, it's one of the things I liked about Jacques Vallée's stuff is that he points out that a lot of the encounters people have, a lot of the things people see, seem as if they're designed to be absurd.
Yeah,
and that's why he equates it with the whole fairy mythology. It seems that, you know, the fairy encounters are surreal.
Yeah. Yeah, one of your essays was about fairy fishing. And I saw I saw the title, it's like, is this people trying to attract fairies with bait? No, that has nothing to do with what you wrote about. But what you wrote about was very interesting, and you know how it was almost now that I think of it, it was almost an Ancient Aliens essay.
Oh no.
No, I mean I'm not trying to throw you in that category, but you know, it was something I'd never really heard of. How did the Maori learn to fish? Well, the little people that lived up in the mountains, which sound exactly like the Celtic fairy lore, well, not exactly, but pretty close. They caught them unawares, or they saw them fishing, and the sun came up, and the fairies had to leave, and they left their fishing nets, and that's how they figured it out.
Yeah, it was the first instance of corporate espionage.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories like that that just are so amazing. And another thing that's very interesting often is how people react to them. I think I've gotten more angry emails from people who are terribly offended when I wrote an article about how unicorns were jerks.
What did they say? First of all, what did you say in the – and as soon as I see that, I think this is going to be a fun satirical piece. But what happened?
Well, no, I
didn't read it.
I said until the monks in the Middle Ages got around to basically rewriting unicorn stories into propaganda and the bestiaries as a stand-in for Christ, and then came in the whole only a virgin can attract them and all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah,
and they became the magical, you know, critters that run around and dance in rainbows and such. The earlier stuff says they're nasty little critters. That they have a long ongoing hatred of elephants, and they disembowel them with their horns, and just all sorts of terrible things that are reported about these creatures. And
poop rainbows, you know, so.
Exactly. And boy, you know, I had people sending me Wikipedia pages on unicorns to prove me wrong and saying what a horrible human being I was for, you know, saying such things about an enchanted animal. And
Batman can so beat up Superman, I'll prove it to you.
Yeah, it was just very strange. Or I think I said that Wait, I'm trying to think of another one. Oh, I said there was a mad science gap. That we worry too much about there being all these other gaps. What we have is a mad science gap. Not enough mad scientists out there coming up with, you know, killer robots and things like that. We're falling behind. And wow, I just somebody was very, very offended by that. They thought I was jumping on the bandwagon of saying there weren't enough women in science. I don't know how they got that. I said, you know, forget about, you know, women in science. Yes, obviously there's not enough women in science, but, you know, we need mad science.
Yes.
So
because that's where the breakthrough come. The breakthroughs come. Look at the Nazis, for Christ's sake. They had a lot of breakthroughs because they were totally off the map from other people. They didn't answer to anybody. And their science got very strange in a lot of ways, and it also got very advanced in a lot of ways.
Well, that's a question that's also puzzled me is why do they keep making killer robots? Have we not agreed that that's a bad idea?
Who's making killer robots now? I guess probably DARPA is sponsoring that.
Well, you know, they keep coming up with more and more automation for their drones and things like that.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's like, have we learned nothing?
No, I don't think any of us should welcome our new robot overlords. Although, you know, I'm going to be the first one in the robot's mouth when they come, you know, come down the street eating people. So,
yeah, just in case I speak nicely to my laptop every night and put it to bed, you know, maybe it'll put in a good word for me when the time comes.
Yeah, well, all my stuff's Apple because I've been using those since the early 90s because it's the only thing that did graphics then. And I just kind of got sucked into their universe. And now they're the biggest? I think they have. They're probably one of the richest non-oil or military contractor companies in the world.
Oh, yeah.
I think – actually, they are. Didn't they supplant like AT&T or – I can't remember who it was.
Yeah, I don't remember, but they're definitely – they had a great idea. They really did market very early on to graphic designers, and they really picked up that niche market and – very smart.
Yeah, well, it worked for me, and then they were the movie industry niche market too. And now that's in the last few years that's started to fall apart. But that's fine. I mean, they keep moving on. So anyway, so basically, Apple will have everything, and if you have Apple products, their robots won't eat you. And maybe they'll have the best robots. They're making a car now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're apparently they have all these people. They don't talk about it very much, but they've hired all these car designers. So this is going to be an iCar or something. Who knows? All I'm waiting for, and this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, all I'm waiting for is an electric car with some range that doesn't cost $70,000.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
I heard they can make it. They keep talking about the great batteries that scientists are coming up with, but they have yet to make it out to us.
Yeah, not yet. I mean, what's it? Tesla says they're having I'm sorry. I just looked out the window, and I saw a guy driving by, and his passenger was standing up through the sunroof.
No, it's Los Angeles, right? Hollywood.
I don't often see that. I mean, the guy was like most – like his body, I think from like just below his waist down was in the car. The rest of it was just standing up, driving around. Absurd. But yeah, they just came out with, I guess, some kind of super battery that's supposed to like suck power off the grid at night where it costs less and then discharge it during the day and therefore, you know, spread the power consumption out a little more. More evenly. Who knows? I don't know if those batteries work in cars. Anyway.
You know, I was listening to your interview with Red Pill Junkie, the last one
you
did.
Wow, you listen to a lot of them. I'm kind of embarrassed.
Oh, yeah.
I like that, though. Go ahead.
Like I said, I'm new to this radio thing. I wanted to, after I said yes, I wanted to see what I was getting into.
It's just, on my show, it's like having a conversation. I don't know about other shows. Other shows, ask a question, have an answer. But that seems to be changing a little bit. I just like talking to people because I want to learn things from people. And a question and answer format does not do that for me.
Yeah, it's kind of constraining, isn't it?
Yeah. So what did you learn about listening to Red Pill?
Well, yeah, it was an interesting conversation, and you know, it lapsed into some talk about categorization and narrative. Of course, I'm kind of interested in, and it made me start thinking about why we feel the need to identify things like UFOs as existing or not existing, and how we go about doing it.
Yeah.
And as I was thinking about this, I started talking to my 6-year-old.
No, that's a good idea.
Well, you know, I wanted to get a perspective.
A fresh perspective.
Yeah, who hadn't really, you know, read too much of the same stuff I had. And he can confidently assert that zombies and vampires don't exist.
And sex.
Yeah, but he can also confidently assert that Santa and the Tooth Fairy do.
Oh, okay. That's good.
And I thought about why is that? And the most obvious reason to me was that they give you stuff.
Yeah.
And so you have, well, I mean, physical evidence, I suppose.
Yes.
But that we, I thought, how can we apply that to UFOs? And I'm like, well, what are we waiting for? Are we waiting, what is the expectation? And I wonder if in a lot of the belief system, and I'm not dismissing it as real or unreal. You've read some of my stuff, so you know that sort of division makes very little difference to me.
Yeah.
But the that what are we hoping for? What do we think that somehow they're going to save us in some mysterious way, save us from ourselves? You know, clean up the environment.
It's segments of the population. I mean, there's schools. There's the, you know, good aliens people and the abduction aliens people and the aliens in league with the government people and everything in between. And that's been going on since probably even before the UFO era in different formats, as you know. You know, yeah. good fairy folk, bad ones, ways you should treat them, what their habits are. People have that all built up for the alien stuff, too, at least in the West. I don't know what people think of this in Africa or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because I saw something on, I forget whether it was Twitter or Tumblr, one of these social media sites, where somebody who was Hindu said, "Can you please stop calling my gods mythological and then acting like yours are are somehow more real?"
Yeah, well, everybody that makes everybody, at least on this side of things, feel better, I guess. See, that reminds me of the what was that show? One of my favorite shows ever, comedy show. Oh, TV Funhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of the main characters were all puppets. I mean, as an adult, it was on a Comedy Central, I think. The main characters were all puppets, but they'd all go to their own churches, and the lobster went to a church, and the sheep went to a church, and the dog went to a church, and they all had crosses with a lobster, a sheep, a dog, a cat, all nailed to crosses in their respective churches, which is exactly what's going on. I mean, you create your thing in your own image, which can apply actually to a lot of things. Yeah. Some of these fringe things we're talking about, I think a lot of this stuff is created in our own image. And you know, tell me what you think of this, because I've been whining about this on the show. I think that when faced with something absurd, your brain in survival and this is also learning from some of my guests in survival or panic mode or whatever, will latch on to the first thing that either can help you or make you feel better. And then in retrospect, in your memory, in your retelling of it, that it further gets changed into whatever you feel is the most useful, least frightening, whatever you want to call it. And that becomes the memory. And who knows what the hell the original stimulus was.
Well, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I see a monster shrimp in my basement. Well, did it really look like a shrimp? Well, no, that's the closest thing I could come up with that it looked like, and what it actually was, or, you know, whether it actually looked like a shrimp, or whether I even know what a giant monster shrimp would look like, are other questions. And I think we do that cognitively. We fill in gaps, and those gaps sometimes are gaps in our either emotional ability or gaps in our perception. And it's a very normal phenomena, I think. It seems that I don't want to chalk everything up to being a sort of a filling in the blank sometimes.
I wouldn't think so either. I just think that happens a lot. Who knows if there's going to be a talking cat asking you if it's hot. I would tend to think there probably wasn't actually a talking cat telling everybody it was hot. But that was a lot of people, according to the story, so who knows?
Yeah, and sometimes and that's why I like detailed, absurd stories where there are multiple witnesses. Because sometimes it's just there's so much detail from so many people that, I mean, I see why, you know, Charles Fort throws up his hand sometimes and says, I Don't know.
You know what would have been interesting is to get all those people, all the witnesses, immediately separate them right after the event and all ask them what happened.
Yeah.
I bet it would be all over the map.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, sometimes I wonder about the kind of questions that get asked. What was that? Dave Berkowitz, you know, the killer who listened to the dog. So he was listening to a dog who was telling him to kill people. And then there's a famous guy in the Middle Ages, I want to say Abel de la Rue, or who listened to a giant black dog that told him to do all sorts of horrible things. And my question isn't whether the dog is talking to them. It's why are you listening to the dog?
Yes.
Because he can't have your best interests in mind. He's a dog.
Yeah, one, he's a dog, and he's telling you to do things which I think you probably know are not right.
Yeah. And it's
– And where does that go? Does that mean – is that an excuse? Or is that just – is that a focus for their craziness?
But to me, it tells us less about this, that there are strange and absurd things happening in the universe, that people can behave strangely and absurdly when faced with strange and absurd things.
Yeah.
That they say, hey, I should listen to this dog. I mean, he drinks out of the toilet, but he must have, you know, he must know what's going on.
He must know what's going on. He knows everything about me. He knows how to get my attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I think The sort of filling in of perceptive gaps and filling in of various other kinds of conscious gaps and trying to describe some of this phenomena is a very plausible explanation. I mean, I don't rule out the fact that there are monsters and there are ghosts and there are these things. I mean, there's lots of possibilities.
Yeah.
And I do that because, well, I spend most of my time sitting around thinking up things to scare people.
Is that what you're doing with your blog with Esoterics? You're just trying to scare people?
Well, it's not so much scare people as to point out that the world is a vast and scary place and you should consider hiding for a while.
So you're just kind of like out there. You're the town crier out there telling everybody that to be there.
Well, like I said, it's not a labor of love. It's a labor of neurosis. And I try to think of the things that make me worry.
You're gonna scare the bejesus out of your kids if you haven't already.
They were raised on Scooby-Doo. Everything is just a mask.
That's right. And you know what? That's a really good model.
But incidentally, and if people who don't have kids probably aren't exposed to the new Scooby-Doo stuff. It's not all that new now, but it just started. It aired a couple of years ago. But they made some new Scooby-Doos that were a lot more edgy.
Edgy how? What? Did, like, Daphne take her clothes off or something? What happened?
Oh, well, no. It was a whole storyline with all sorts of cool occult themes and things like that about saving the world from some menacing, evil, interdimensional alien that wasn't a mask. Very, very different from the ones we all grew up on. You know, those
Scooby-Doo. To get to today's guest screenwriter, Phil K. Dick.
They actually, believe it or not, they had Harlan Ellison as a character. That's how edgy they were.
Wow. Well, see, a lot of cartoons do that now. Well, they have been since like Tiny Toons and probably before that. They're writing for an adult audience. They just have to like kind of cater to kids.
Yeah, well, they also had a character that was very thinly veiled, H.P. Lovecraft. They called him L.P. Hatecraft or something, but he was another important character in the whole thing. But it very, very much moved away from the idea that, and again, we all grew up on Scooby-Doo where it was always a guy in a mask.
Yeah, it was always old man, whatever it is, telling those wacky kids that they would have gotten away with it if they hadn't. Oh, those meddling kids, they would have gotten away with it.
Yeah. And if I had the terminology when I was 8 years old, I probably would have been, these people are horrible logical positivists. You know, I didn't. You know, they rely purely on physicalism, but I just thought it was cool and I like Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
But now I think we're seeing a lot more, and I think this is in a lot of ways, I think we're seeing more interest in strange phenomena by the general public, but it's a kind of interest that I'm not sure it
helps.
It doesn't necessarily help. I think it leans a lot towards conspiracy. We see conspiracies everywhere, and this is probably because there are conspiracies everywhere. But
the people have been lied to so many times by people who are trying to get money or power or whatever that, unfortunately, and in a lot of cases, I think they're right. They assume that now from the get go.
Absolutely, and I
don't blame them. Although it's not a healthy situation.
No, not at all. And you start to wonder whether you're being tricked a lot.
Yeah.
And that it kind of feeds back into this idea that, well, the universe isn't absurd. The universe is being manufactured to be absurd. And that's where I start to shy away. I think it's very easy to say somebody is doing – it's kind of like saying somebody's creating hoaxes just to confuse us. And I think they don't need to create hoaxes to confuse us. We're already confused.
the codification, the industrialization, the taking all the weirdness, and then the entertainment part of the military entertainment industrial uses that for whatever it needs to get people to believe whatever, you can call it some kind of vast disinformationalist conspiracy, but the weirdness keeps coming, though, and I think it's for the kind of people that are into it and have kind of inquiring anarchistic view of the world. It doesn't particularly matter, and they don't get hooked on something, some particular idea or philosophy of something, which is not very many people. Those people will be fine,
yeah.
But. Yeah, it is. I never really thought about that, codifying the weird so that it can be used for other ends. Well, you know what? That's stupid. That's the message of Messengers of Deception,
yeah.
Basically.
And Operation Trojan Horse. And
yeah.
A lot of these things are these are the things you would do if you were trying to cover things up or hide some deeper, darker truth. And I think, it's like you said, we've been lied to so much that we do tend to believe that, somebody is out there nefariously doing something.
Yeah.
And, there aren't evil geniuses out there.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that turns you away from the coarse weirdness, absurdity of it. And wherever that's coming from, because you want to assign it to something, I can't remember who said that. Oh, it was a Discordian. One of the very first Discordian quotes. Somebody had to have put all this weirdness here.
Yeah. it's what you said before. It's another form of sort of perceptive filling in.
It's
a way to explain something that might otherwise be unexplainable. And that's a reason sometimes I say that, anomalous should not be so concerned with whether science takes them seriously. Because you know what? You're not even shooting at the same target. Science is about explaining the natural world, and you're looking at what, for all intents and purposes,
the unnatural world.
It's unnatural, exactly. So why are you, why do we often, and I'm guilty of this too, why do we want to be taken seriously?
Yeah, that's stupid. Abandon that completely.
Yeah.
See, that's another ego thing. It's like, do you want to learn, the first thing, and two, have fun, and then three, there's this vague thing of finding an answer. And if you can couch it in those terms, I think you do fine. So it's helped me so far, and
yeah.
People I know. Stay curious, but don't get locked into something, because then you start sounding crazy to people. You start sounding crazy to people who are into the same thing you are if you get locked
yep.
into one idea.
Yeah. Well, one thing I liked a lot about John Keel's sort of take on it, on strange phenomena in general, was I kind of think of him as the Hunter S. Thompson. He's the Gonzo anomalist.
Yes. Yes. Very, very much so. And in fact, when I met him, I was such a fanboy, I think I stuttered for about half an hour. But go ahead.
Yeah, that idea that there, don't take yourself so seriously, don't take the phenomena so seriously that you get wrapped up in one explanation for
yeah.
it. That there we may never, and again, this all stems from an absurdist philosophy that you may never find that transcendent meaning, and who cares? Finding a meaning is the interesting process. It's like the process is the important part.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. The journey is the important part, I guess.
Yeah,
and if you find an answer, quote unquote, then one, beware of it, and two, well, fine, good for you, but you better not stay with that answer, because it, invariably it's not going to answer every question. So yeah, just the Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson thing of just, you know, switching channels on your belief system is probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, and I think being able to mock your own thinking, it's always fun to mock other people's thinking too, but
yeah.
Being able to mock your own thinking, you have to be able to make jokes of things, because people, and it's always a sign for
me. Oh, it's very important. That's like the Emperor's New Clothes or whatever, the jester.
Yeah, you can speak some truth through making jokes,
yeah.
But people who can't joke about their subject of study, and you run into this a lot in academia, I believe that they are not capable of thinking very deeply about the subject, because that's what a joke is. It's being able to pull it apart and piece it back together and see what doesn't fit and see what fits and see what just seems absurd. And if you don't have that perspective, it becomes very difficult to get out of this box where I believe this and this phenomena either meets my criteria or it doesn't meet my criteria. And if it doesn't meet my criteria, then anybody who's seen it, done it, experienced it is either crazy or mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing of trying to stuff something into one view of things. It just becomes, no, after a while, the older you get, the less people will listen to you.
Yeah. Starting with your children and then.
Yeah. Well, the most important thing is your children not listen to you. I mean, that's it. I talked to a friend of mine with some kids the other day, and there's your official Radio Mysterioso siren.
All right.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend. Are they?
Huh?
They're not coming for you, are they?
No.
I'm just joking.
I always think they are, but they always turn the corner. I was talking to a friend, and I told him about the John Waters quote that I read. I think it was in his book, Shock Value. He said, if you don't have to pick your kids up from jail at least once while they're growing up, then they're probably not worth a damn. And I wholeheartedly agree. And I agree when it applies to all this stuff's going on, too. I mean, if you don't have enough people mad at you for some reason – or not, at least, you know, vociferously disagreeing with you, then what difference does it make? I don't want to join a club where everybody's talking about the same thing and just patting each other on the back, because it gets boring really quickly. I mean, it's a herd mentality thing, I guess. And of course you want to have friends and have, you know, people with like-minded interests. But, you know, repeating UFO stories or whatever it is back and forth and saying how crazy or why isn't the government tell us what we want to hear. It's a circle jerk. And, you know, who likes that? It just reminded me during the Red Pill Junkie interview, we had a little bit in there about, is it more helpful to discuss things with people that agree with you or people that don't agree with you?
Well, I think you're going to end up,
I guess, doing it's different both. Sides of the same coin.
Well, I think you have to do both, because you have to, the people who do agree with you can help you refine what you're thinking, while the people who disagree with you might can also help you refine your thinking.
Yeah, they point out problems in your argument.
Exactly.
That either makes you change your argument or find evidence or whatever reasons to tell them that they're full of it and that you don't have to worry about that.
And you rapidly find out whether you're coming from incommensurable paradigms. It is abundantly clear very quickly. And, you know, there are very few people that are that extreme, I think, like I said, I don't want to get down on anybody's hustle, but they have an agenda that they're pushing, and that agenda may be very well intentioned. They may truly believe what they believe, but if they can't consider any other possibilities, it's problematic. I think another big problem is that, especially when it comes to the world of strange phenomena and anomalistics, is that satire as social criticism, it's really just, it's been completely replaced with just of general impoliteness and snarkiness. I'm not against being impolite. What I'm against.
No, not at all. But you're a hijacking of comedy for a very narrow purpose rather than the useful purpose of pointing out what's wrong and making people aware of it by laughing at it, but then saying, this is a very serious problem. You know, Lenny Bruce did that and George Carlin did it and
absolutely
Bill Hicks and all these, you know, everybody, anybody worth anything does that. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
But what do you think it's symptomatic of? Because I've been trying to wrap my head around that is satire dead, and why, and when did it happen, and how?
I don't know. I think maybe the main reason might be the internet and texting and the way people deal with each other, which is a little impersonal. Two, you can find out anything to shore up anything that you may be thinking at that very moment instantly. So there's no real, what's the word? You don't get any, you can't be introspective. You don't have time to think about things. And so you're going to go to the thing that makes the most sense quickest, and satire doesn't. And the third part of that is that you need a cultural literacy to understand a lot of satire. And I think a lot of people, there's a lot of cultural literacy that has been lost.
Yeah, or certainly fragmented a lot.
And historical, too.
Yeah, we have multiple cultures now that often are just living side by side and not really engaging.
Yeah, and a third thing is I think people are afraid of offending people, and people are too offended too quickly.
Yeah.
You know, if Richard Pryor was around now, I think that people would be very uncomfortable with him in a way that did not happen in the 70s and 80s or when he was truly, you know, really active. I had an argument with my girlfriend once. She goes, "You can't say what did I said?" I think I said I used the word mulatto, and she said, "You can't say that word." And I said, "What? You know me. You know what kind of person I am. And if you bother to ask, you'll know I'm not using it in a racist way." She goes, "Well, people don't know that." And I said, "Well, then tough shit.
Yeah.
If they don't like it, they can ask me."
Which is exactly why Richard Pryor used it, and it's. As he was demystifying it, he was taking the power out of it. There's I don't think there's a lot of the introspection where people say, "Hey, that's what he's doing" anymore. So you're right. You know,
no, they just react right away and they don't think of the deeper meaning behind any of that. A lot of the Monty Python stuff, I think, would go over people's heads now. Saturday Night Live, the first few years, a lot of that stuff, I think, would either go over people's heads or they just say, "That isn't funny. That's not very nice."
Yeah. Do you remember when Buckwheat was shot?
On Saturday Night?
On Saturday Night Live, it was Eddie Murphy doing Buckwheat is Shot, and they would keep going back to the videotape. They'd stop everybody they could find, and they'd say, "Have you seen the videotape?" And they show the videotape. They showed this videotape about 100 times during the show.
I vaguely remember that. Just the one I remember is Buckwheat sings all your favorite songs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't remember that one, but it was absurd, and it's become that way.
Yeah.
That was 20 years before that was going on. I mean, they used to do that, but now that's what news stations do. They show the damn whatever it is hundreds of times.
Yeah. Yeah. They prefigured a 24-hour news channel that doesn't have enough news to report.
The funny thing was Alfalfa was shot. That's how he died. Somebody came to his door and shot him in the stomach or something.
Oh, Lord.
Alfalfa Switzer. Yeah, he's buried in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery right over here about a mile from me.
Really?
Yeah, about a mile from the studio, the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Who else is there? Johnny Ramone. I mean, it's been there forever. Tyrone Power is there. And, you know, God, who else? Mel Blanc.
Does Johnny Ramone get as many visitors as, like, Morrison's grave?
I think so, but the thing is they keep it nice and clean. If you've been to Morrison's grave, you notice every few months the place just gets covered in graffiti. Then they go clean it all up, and then it just comes back a few months later.
Yep.
Including all the people's graves around there, because he doesn't have a big one. It's a little marker with somebody made a bust of his head and put it on top.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, no, the Hollywood Forever Cemetery is I guess you could start doing some kind of graffiti in it, but I don't think it would last very long because they keep it pretty. They keep it in good shape because it went into disrepair for a while, and some new owners got it probably 10 years ago. And now they show the movies there and the whole bit. So there's always people around there.
Yeah, can't get in there and graffiti anymore, I suppose.
No, not really. And then if you go to Forest Lawn, that's the big place where all the really famous people are buried. And they, I don't see anybody around there either, but I think people are kind of scared to start marking up graveyards. There might be some kind of weird superstitions like, oh, don't go and mess with graveyards, which is fine because when you go there, everything's nice and clean. And there, did you ever see the movie? Stop honking. Did you ever see the movie The Loved One?
No, I didn't.
That is, speaking of satire, it was based on an Evelyn Waugh novel called The Loved One. It was basically a satire of the funeral industry. And there's scenes in the movie where this woman is walking through this graveyard and there's music playing. You think it's just incidental music? No, it's music's being played in the graveyard. And I went to Forest Lawn and I was walking around like one of the more Tony mausoleums, you know, like where Walt Disney's family is buried and
sure.
Errol Flynn and all that. There's music playing there. There's music playing there when there's nobody there.
Eternally.
It's probably like the tree in the forest. But as you come closer, I was like, who's playing music? And I realized it was coming over speakers. So, you know, the satire was based on something that was really going on.
there's definitely a few places out there that are still have a sense. It's funny. I'll be moving to California. I'm New York based now. And I was looking for what town in the Bay Area in San Francisco that I wanted to live in, and ran across a little town called Colma. And I don't know if
is that the town of the dead?
Exactly. That because you can't bury people in San Francisco. They've been burying them in Colma for, you know, 200 years. And so they the dead outnumber the living something like a million to one in Colma. But that's not the best part about it. It's the town has such a good sense of humor about it that the town slogan is, it's great to be alive in Colma.
And it's shitty to be dead there, I guess. I don't know. It's great to be dead at Forest Lawn, I think.
Yeah, music.
Yeah, you get music. Well, most of this graveyard didn't have music, but there's a couple like mausoleum kind of outdoor areas, and you know, a few areas outside the mausoleum where music was playing constantly, which really I actually started laughing when I realized that was going on. I mean, I was by myself, so I just started cracking up. Like, well, they're playing music here. This is amazing.
one puzzling thing about graveyards is that, have you seen some pictures of those statues? I understand, you know, graveyards are going to be creepy regardless. People don't like to think about death, but there's sometimes those creepy statues that they put. There's a famous one. It's a weeping woman in a shroud sitting down.
Yeah.
And it's the scariest looking thing I've ever seen. It's like, why would you put that in a cemetery as if a cemetery isn't scary enough?
Yeah, well, what they try to do in most cemeteries is not have stuff like that. It's just supposed to be a nice, you know, peaceful place with a lot of grass covered with gravestones.
Yeah.
Oh, the other person that's buried, which I thought was very strange and wonderful at Forest Lawn, is L. Frank Baum.
Really?
Yeah. And I think his wife or something like that. And if you go to his people put stuff on the gravestone, and a whole bunch of people have put plastic emeralds on it. And about three spaces away is Charles Hatfield, who was the Rainmaker, that Rainmaker movie with Spencer. No, who was it that was in there? God, I can't remember who did it. It was called The Rainmaker. Katharine Hepburn and, you know, somebody's going to type it in for me, but here.
Terrible with.
Yeah. But he is, I don't know how he got in that cemetery with the rest of his family, but he's the guy that ran around California in the early 20th century telling people that he could make it rain and making a good living at it. And you know, the point of the movie, which is probably a really good – Burt Lancaster. Thank you, Carlos. The point of the movie was that people are more interested in the salesman. What they care about is the show. They don't really care so much about the rain. At least in the movie, they cared more about the show. They cared more about what they thought that rainmaking involved. And they were very hooked on the salesman's patter, and the rain was kind of an afterthought. In fact, I think when it rains at the end of the movie, Burt Lancaster's kind of surprised that it worked.
So it's funny because that's the whole spiritualist movement, you know, the table rappings and things like that.
Hey, it's something to do.
It's a performance, absolutely. But it's a performance, but occasionally maybe something happens, and then the people who are doing it are just as freaked out as everybody else.
Yeah, I asked one of my guests about that once, Tim Cridland, because I think he had researched this a little bit, and he's a sideshow performer guy. He's known as the Torture King. You know, he sticks needles through his tongue and walks on coals and eats glass and stuff like that. But I asked him, I don't know how the subject came up, but he goes, there is a certain history of magicians performing magic for many years, and then magic stuff starts happening around them, stuff that doesn't make any sense, that would be considered magic, quote unquote, and it freaks them out. it's like an occult, you know, performance, like doing the crop circles, and people see lights and stuff flying around while they're making the crop circles.
You know the story about, I can't remember his full name, but I think it's Jean Houdin, the French magician.
Yeah, I don't know what the story about him, but I know Houdini named himself after Houdin. Well,
he was thought to be one of the best magicians of his time in France, and they were having some problems in Algeria at the time with some local religious leaders. They were calling
them... Is this the electric box thing? The box you couldn't lift?
Oh, he had a couple tricks. I can't remember which trick it was, but it wasn't so much the trick. It's that they were having problems with an insurgency of led by what they were calling wizards. And their reaction was to show them that French magic, which they deny that magic existed, but they sent something to show them that French magic was stronger magic than their magic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I found a little bit meta.
It is. It's great. I mean, it's like, you know, it sounds like a William Burroughs story almost.
Absolutely.
And well, the other story, which I saw on a TV show that I'm addicted to, Mysteries at the Museum, I think. It was I think there was another problem with it. Maybe it was Houdin, but I'm not sure. But they sent this box that had electromagnets in it. And showed these tribal leaders, set up a performance for them to show them that their magic or whatever it was better than theirs and that they should be scared of them. What they did was they had a box and they had this little girl come up on stage or, you know, a woman or something come up on stage and lift the box up. It's like, sure, see, it's a very light box. And then they had the strongest man in the tribe come up and try and pick it up. They flipped a switch in the back and turned on these electromagnets, and of course it's never going to come off the floor.
Yep.
And then they turned the switch back off and had, you know, the little girl come pick it up again. And that you know, it stopped the insurgency because it freaked out the local population, or at least the leadership of the local population.
Yep.
They're not seeing what they expect.
Yeah. But it's amazing that, and that it's funny because that's a perfect example of manipulating a true conspiracy to manipulate the what would otherwise be considered a strange phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. You know, any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that. That I'm not sure whether that's
a hard and fast rule.
Yeah, I wonder if that would be true. Ultimately, if we went back with to the Middle Ages with a gun.
Yeah,
I get the feeling a guy with a crossbow would pretty much recognize what he was looking at. You know, that shoot something, and I better get out of the way.
Yeah, but if you showed him an iPod, his head would explode.
Yeah,
but the thing is, if you you know, if you had somebody who's sufficiently, you know, versed in the local language to explain to somebody, no, people made this and it works according to, you know, laws of electricity. If you don't know about electricity, and, you know, the point is that I think somebody once explained that Neanderthals would be able to play video games within 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because the brains haven't changed. It's just, you know, what they're dealing with has changed. And people have been smart enough to handle a lot of this stuff for millions of years, apparently. At least that's the because the DNA is the same. And the evolution, I think, has to do with probably more environmental stuff than the brain getting any smarter, at least at this point.
Well, and that's something that's always puzzled me about the need to say that there was some sort of otherworldly intervention in building the pyramids or this or that, because, you know, why build a pyramid? Because a pyramid looks cool. I mean, do you need another reason? You're a god king and you want something that looks cool.
Yeah.
And it doesn't require us to have a knowledge that's beyond human beings. You know, maybe we forgot how to do it for a while. I mean, we lost concrete for a few hundred years.
That's right.
So it's just
the pantheon's made out of concrete and nothing in the Middle Ages was.
Yeah. It's just, we feel this need to sort of think that no one before us could possibly have come up with a way to do something that didn't require, alien intervention or magical power, things like that.
My other favorite guilty pleasure on TV right now is a show called Ancient Impossible, and they explain how a lot of things were built, mostly how the Romans built things.
Oh, I love that show. I'm addicted to that kind of show.
Yeah. It's just like, well, you don't think you don't think we could have made concrete? Well, we did this. You don't think they could have drained a lake? Oh, what was the last one? I think it was Caligula's giant, floating palace.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you're looking at it, it's like, what? This existed? It was like 400 feet long. It had rotating statues in it. It had a heating system in the floor. It's like, what? And it's like, they pointed out a lot of this stuff was not on ships until maybe in the last century.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's I think that, you know, the effort to educate people about what is not really it's not an exponential or whatever the word is, not exponential. It's not a steady, climb from ignorance to intelligence or whatever sophistication. It's fits and starts and up and down and left and right and who knows what. And people tend to forget that. And then because they've been lied to so much, like we've been talking about before, the next thing is to say, well, then it must be, you know, something that's way smarter than us that told us how to do this.
So it's usually also why I have a bone to pick with historians, because how much has burned, how much has been destroyed, how much has been just plain lost. We lose stuff. We lose islands all the time, you know.
Oh yeah, I like that that one essay you had. Go ahead, I want to talk about that essay, the blog entry you did.
Oh I mean, anything from High Brazil to Taranaki to actual island. Saxenburg is another great one that vanished, and maybe it never existed. Maybe it did. Yeah, who knows? We weren't so good with, you know, latitude and longitude for many years.
A lot of stuff has just gone missing, and then somebody says Eureka. It's like, hey, what should we call it? Did this 400 years ago. Your brain working on the same problem came up with the same solution.
Well, and so often when I think I've made this comment before in various essays, is that historians are arguing over scraps. We're trying to piece together what happened based on those few scraps we can find.
Yeah, and I think you also pointed out they're trying to piece things together based on recollections, egos, lies.
Absolutely. You know, somebody wanted to be there first.
Yeah.
So just in case, they said they discovered the island, whether it was there or not, because, well, you know, you claim it for queen and country, whether it's there or not. And if it turns out to be there, well, you claimed it, so it's yours.
Well, the essay you wrote was about, what was the island?
Tuanaki or Tuanaki. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it was, yeah.
Tuanaki.
It was near Rarotonga in the South Pacific, I guess. And it was, nobody claimed anything special about it. They just said it was there.
Yeah, and there were people that lived there, and they were kind of like the people that lived a couple hundred miles away on another island.
Yeah, we traded stuff with them, and one day it's just gone. And there's perfectly reasonable explanations for why it might be gone, but that leads you to ask, there's lots of other islands that have disappeared. Could that have happened elsewhere?
Yeah, well, what other explanations? Like, they just got the directions wrong? But you said a few people had gone there. And it talked about it in very mundane terms.
Oh, yeah. They interviewed a crew, said they landed there and stayed there for 6 days, resupplied their ship, and then came back. And so it was there. There was absolutely nothing. It wasn't as if they were claiming that this was the, you know, the island of Atlantis or some such, you know, magical realm with high technology. They said these are, you know, it's a bunch of people related to us. We speak pretty much the same language. We trade stuff with them, and then it's gone. Nobody can find it again. And maybe they got the, you know, like I said, you know, we were very good. I forget, we were good with longitude, but we were terrible with latitude.
Or no, good with latitude, but bad with longitude, I think. Because latitude, you had the North Star, you said. You could just look, see how far it was above the horizon at a certain time at night all the time.
Right. And until recent, you know, until the 19th century or late 19th century and later, we weren't very good at figuring out exactly where our ship was. And so people miss stuff all the time.
So go ahead.
And, you know, you make fun of the previous person who said there was nothing out there. And then you carry on. You say there's nothing there. He made it up. And you go back to your business. But then, you know, it's always a problem when somebody later discovers there is actually an island.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about it now, and I'm glad that you brought it up and I remember to ask you, was the point of that essay that the island disappeared? Or was the point of that essay, we don't know whether it disappeared or not, but
that's exactly
the way
it.
People communicated then, and we have no idea.
That's exactly it. We have no idea whether it was ever in existence, and... It
but that's so
like
inconclusive. That hurts. I don't like it.
I know. But it's that's sort of. I think where I was going with that is making a statement about mythology. Is that thing we don't see an island there, and we say this is mythology. It never existed. It never was there. This is a story, as a sailor's story in the South Pacific, and. How many things do we say that about that perhaps did actually exist and somehow disappeared?
Yeah, who knows? Because in between the storytelling, the recollection, the bad directions, you don't know if something actually disappeared unless you go back there and you see steeples sticking up from the bottom of the ocean or something.
Yeah, well, and you can, I think a lot of times folklore, when people say, oh, that's just folklore, it's kind of they're using it in a, I hate to say it. It sounds
dismissive. Like,
it's dismissive, but it's also a kind of class consciousness. It's like the people you're willing to accept the belief of it. That's the kind of stuff that happens in trailer parks, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that probably goes for all sorts of phenomena that people say, well, that can't happen because only people who live in the hollers in the backwoods see
would
stuff
believe
like
that. Yeah.
But then when you present them with the simple fact that plenty of very intelligent, you know, and famous scientists, Linnaeus, you know, saw ghosts. I mean that, you know, you wouldn't, if Einstein told you he saw a ghost, would you say, nah, you're an idiot?
No, if you wanted to say now you're an idiot, you'd say you must be mistaken, or maybe you were half asleep.
Yeah, but it would be much harder for us to dismiss, and that's because we sort of have this hierarchy of who we're willing to believe.
Yeah, your point is well taken. Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what the UFO people are all on about, and I guess to some extent, some other anomaly research people. It's like if we can just get respectable people to. Tell us that we're right, then everything will be fine.
Yeah, and it's like they are setting themselves up to fail because that quest for respectability is a losing game because you're playing by rules that don't apply to what you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. It's never going to happen, so stop it.
Yeah.
You know, is it not enough to have the answer – get a little bit closer to an answer and enrich yourself with you and your friends? Or is it more important for somebody in the white, somebody at a university say, yeah, you're right, there's UFOs and aliens are coming from another planet.
It's like you said, that's where the ego comes into it. Yeah. So you want both. You want the meaning, but you also want somebody to
validation.
Yeah.
validation from people that you think everybody else trusts, and generally you're right, but it doesn't, you know, the rules don't apply. That actually, I wrote down a few questions. That's one of them. What I exactly wrote was, is science able to deal with anomalies, or is there no hope? You know, what do you think? The scientific method? I don't think so. It has to be changed.
Well, I think. Well, it's funny because a lot of people have pointed out that when you start talking to theoretical physicists these days, they're sounding more and more mystical.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That I think there is some utility that, but it's right now the paradigm in science is very. It's a physicalist paradigm. I mean, with a nod towards consciousness as having some role.
Yes.
But it's a very begrudging role that consciousness is allowed, and it's usually to point out the errors that the human mind can make.
Right.
So I think there's room, but I think a lot of what masquerades as science is skepticism. And I think... skepticism is a whole different story. And
you mean the cult of skepticism, or what I call fundamentalist skepticism, where you start from the point of it cannot be, you must prove it to me, rather than where is the evidence and let's see how that holds up.
Exactly. It's very much attached itself to the science and scientific method. And what's interesting is that you got a lot of people who are skeptical. Didn't they just have QEDCon or something, that big skeptic conference, which to me seems like an odd thing to have a conference about things not existing.
Well, it's a religious conference.
Yeah.
That's in Vegas, right? Don't they have it in Vegas? Or is that the James Randi one?
I think that's the James Randi one. I can't remember where
because
it is.
Penn and Teller, I think, hosted or something, so they always have it in Vegas. Anyway, I did not know about the QED conference.
But the skepticism as the same people who are looking at the same phenomena, you get people who are ghost hunters and they say, I'm a skeptic ghost hunter, right? And I say, you can be no such thing. that animal doesn't exist.
Can you explain that? I think I know what you mean, but can you explain that?
Because the curiosity itself is the important part. To say that I'm looking for ghosts or Bigfoot or UFOs, but I'm a skeptic, is just, in my mind, you know, I'm willing to be wrong, but in my mind, it's code for I'm looking into this stuff, but I'm not crazy like those other guys.
Yeah.
And there's very little to support that.
Yeah, well, see, this is an ego thing again. It's being able to say, aha, you're wrong. You know, you're wrong and you're ignorant and you're not using the scientific method and I'm right and you're not. I mean, I think that's really what it boils down to with a lot of these people. And then secondarily, what they say it is they're trying to save people.
Yeah, and they're very disconcerted when you say, I don't care whether I'm right or wrong. It's not relevant to what I'm doing.
Yeah. There's this gotta be right fetish. On my Facebook, they ask you for a quote, like, you know, what's your life quote or whatever mine is. The mark of a basic shit is he always has to be right. William S. Burroughs.
Oh, I don't know. Mine is probably the Katharine Hepburn quote that I have up on my website.
What? Which one of many? She was a very quotable person.
She said, "Life is hard. After all, it kills you."
Yes, that's right. I did see that one. What people don't realize, unless they go to your site, is we're just talking about probably like two degrees of what you've actually written on the site. There's many other things on there the closest one to my heart was the first one I read, the rabbit hole one.
Yeah, I don't sleep much.
go ahead.
Over 200 of these things. And then
how long have you been doing it? Like 3 years? 2 years?
About 3 years. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Because another one of the ones I enjoyed was the Galactic Ghoul one about Mars probes disappearing about half the time. I didn't know it was that – the record was that poor. I thought it was, you know, like 75%. Half. half the probes that have been sent to Mars have blown up, gone off course, disappeared, been eaten by the galactic ghoul.
Yeah, and that's apparently the running joke, is that there is a great galactic ghoul that eats anything that heads towards Mars.
Well, there was that one, the one that was supposed to, it was approaching Phobos or something like that, and it just I think it was a Russian probe in the 90s or late 80s, and it just disappeared off the radar, didn't communicate or anything. They didn't, I don't think they have radar, but they just completely lost track of it at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Just disappeared. So I didn't realize this had happened with other probes that have been sent there. But who are the only people they're sending? The United States and Russia, right? Has anybody else tried to send any there? India, China?
You know, I don't know. I think that was mostly Russia and the U.S. that every time, you know, what I forget what the actual number was. It's something like 1 in 3 of them have vanished,
yeah,
or crashed.
And you said that at the end of the – somewhere near the end of the essay, you say, are children in the 21st or 22nd century going to be told stories of the galactic ghoul that eats bad space probes or something like that?
Yeah. It's – you know, it's interesting. I another article that I got a lot of hate mail for was
– I was going to ask you about that. What are the strongest reactions and what are they? Go ahead.
Believe it or not, it was the unicorn. Saying unicorns were jerks was probably the one I got the strongest reaction for. But, another one was I wrote about Slender Man and Black Eyed Kids. And instantly out of the woodwork, when you write about anything involving Slender Man, you get hundreds of people sending you things saying, you know, Slender Man was made up by Creepypasta and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, and I say... yes, I know.
Did you read the article?
Yeah, it's the point isn't that it's real. It's not real. I don't care if he's running around the fields of England now. You know, it doesn't.
Right.
It's not important. The point is it represents something. And isn't it kind of weird that the creepiest monster we could come up with is a tall guy with no face in a business suit?
Yes.
I mean, doesn't that say something?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Black Eyed Kids, too. I mean, I first heard about this maybe 5 years ago, and I thought I was late to the party.
And it's recent. There's some obvious interpretations of that. I mean, the death of innocence in the modern era.
Kind of thing.
You know, be afraid of the children. I'm already afraid of the children, so I don't really need them to have black eyes and knock on my door to scare me. But these sorts of things where the question, you know, becomes, well, it's not even a question. The dialogue becomes, well, you know, this is made up. And to which you can only answer... Yeah. That's not the point.
Yeah. Well, you know this is made up. Slam door, go on.
Yeah, exactly.
You slammed the door and went on, but there's still people writing about it, talking about it, and saying absolutely swearing that they saw it.
Sure, which is interesting in and of itself. Yeah. I mean, and that's why I say it.
Not to say that it exists as an external entity or whatever, but what's interesting is that it exists as something people are talking about.
It has some meaning in the human condition, and that's what we're talking about. I mean, it's like I started off by saying, I mean, this is the science of the spirit. You know, we want to understand the human condition. You know, we try really hard, you know, to understand, understand rocks and physics and biology and things like that.
Radio waves and all those things that do the same thing every time, no matter who looks at them.
Exactly, and that's a noble goal. I would never put it down. I like my microwave oven. But is that what we should be talking about when we're starting to talk about these sort of edges of human experience?
I was just looking. Go ahead.
I don't think it is. I think I don't think we should give up on trying to understand human beings in some. In some scientific way, I just think that it's not unproductive to also look at it in terms of how we make meaning.
Yeah. The first thing I think of, strangely enough, when you say that, I was having an argument with a girlfriend once who always thought she was right. And it drove me nuts. But the thing is, I was talking to her for a while about this, and then at some point I realized something. I told her, your argument makes logical sense, but it does not make emotional sense. And she had to concede that she was right. She was not taking into account people's feelings, perceptions, anything like that. Only some sort of opinionated, dry facts thing.
Yeah. And frankly, people's opinions and emotions drive the world.
So yeah.
If you're not taking them into account, it's problematic.
Yeah. And I think that's a big failing of the anomalies people. They're trying to get all this objective evidence of stuff, and I don't think it's going to happen that way until the emotional argument holds more weight.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's about what we talked about earlier, the respectability. It's like this striving for respectability. Here I have physical evidence, and it's chasing the wrong rabbit.
Yeah.
<It's> wrong hole.
Yeah, and until people come out from under the science explains everything, it doesn't, and I don't think it ever will. It explains most things, I think, in our experience right now, but not everything. And there are other parts of our brains, sensory apparatus, emotional makeup, and just what we were talking about, you know, what we consider important in what we talk about in our mythology that are just as important. And that, you know, that's an old argument.
Well, I would say it doesn't explain everything. And I'd add to that it doesn't need to. It's
yeah, that's not, yeah, it's exactly. You're right. Oh, you know what I noticed in your disappearing Tuanaki Island thing? That you had a couple references at the end, because you always put in your references, which is great.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very good academic. I noticed that the sailor or whoever who had gone there, his name was William Gill.
Yes.
There is a famous UFO case from Papua New Guinea involving a Reverend William Gill.
Hmm.
And I looked at it, it's like, what? William Gill? But this is like 100 years before the William Gill I know about.
I wonder if they're related.
Who knows? But it's like one of those weird name game things. Speaking of things that don't make any logical sense.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's like a little weird synchronicities. Like, what's the one, the guy off of, who kept, every time this guy got on a boat, the boat sank and he was the only survivor. And it was, and then like a 10 years later, somebody else survives a boat sinking in the same place, and guy's got the same name.
Yeah. I think Burroughs might have written about that.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think of the other name. I came upon one like that. I wrote a book called Project Beta. Do you know about that book? But well, do you know about the Richard Doty, William Moore, Paul Benowitz thing?
Not in great detail.
Okay. There was a guy that was worked for the Air Force Office of Special Investigation who supposedly passed disinformation to this guy and helped drive him crazy. And but his name was Richard Doty. I was doing some research on one of the first animal mutilation cases that was ever documented in the 1960s, I believe. It was in Colorado. It was called the Snippy the Horse case, where these people found their horse, like, you know, out in the middle of a field. They'd seen it alive the night before, and you know, it had strange substance around it that burned their fingers, and the eyes were gone and stuff like that. But what happened I think they just let the horse rot in the field, and you know, no animals would go near it or anything like that.
Right.
Classic stuff. And then they just got the bones, and I guess somebody bought them off the original owners. And the person that had possession of them most recently, his name was Richard Doty. Not the Richard Doty I knew and had talked to, but a completely different Richard Doty. And I was like, that's not a very common name.
Yeah.
And then one of them is involved in the UFO thing, and one of them is involved with owning the and he was actually involved in trying to stop the spread of cattle mutilation stories. And here's another guy named Richard Doty who owns one of the first cattle mutilation, you know, animal mutilation evidence skeleton, which I found very strange. It's other Fortean people have pointed out. Lauren Coleman, I think, was very into this how names recur throughout places, and how anything with the Fayette, like Fayetteville, Arkansas, it's a word for fairies, and it would have weird stuff attached to that location, which is possibly how they got that name.
Interesting.
Geographical locations, I mean.
Sure. It makes sense. But then you have to ask and I don't have an answer for this, but with these name correspondences, and they're all over the place. You can find them in all sorts of strange places. And I think even Jung talked about it and that.
I didn't know that.
I think I'm not surprised. But I think that what possibly could the significance of it be? I mean, sometimes it's just there's literally two people with the same name connected in some bizarre way. And it's interesting to consider why. And this goes back to my whole theory here that, you know, we're living in an absurd universe and we're just expressing our fear and anxiety about it. That what is that about? Why does that happen? And does it mean anything? Is it significant, or is it just we pick up on it? Or are we seeing, are these things actually happening all the time and we just happen to notice this time?
Well, what I think in this particular case, it's just a little tendril of the where causality does not correspond to time. Like it's called I guess you could call it a strange attractor. Some names are just strange attractors for weird things.
Yeah.
And who knows if that attracted it or somewhere in the universe of connections that this stuff has been, is and always will be connected. And it's just we think it's attracting things, but it's just that's the lattice work under of some sort of, you know, what's the word? Logic? I don't know what it is. The structure underlying all this is inscrutable to us, but it sticks its head up in weird ways like this.
Yeah, and I guess you could also say that it's attached to something. We notice it because it's attached to so many other odd things that, you know, it's so complex. And I guess that's what you mean by structure, that underlying all of this is this complex of odd coincidences and strange phenomena and things. And so, of course, we notice this is yet another of these strange things associated with this particular complex of strange things.
Yeah, you had a quote from Korzybski, I think, about structure.
Oh, yeah.
What was that quote?
Well, you know, it's his from Structural Semantics, where he talks about the map not being the territory. And
right.
That if it's true that the map, and I'm paraphrasing, but if it's true that the map is not the territory, then the only link between reality and language is the structure. And that it's the structure of how we explain things is our only way of
kind of getting at it with the limited tools we have with our banging rocks together language thing.
Exactly. And it never is reality. It's always an approximation. And he simply says the closer the structure, you know, the language is to the actual structure, which is, of course,
inscrutable.
Inscrutable, then the more real it would be in theory. But he argues, obviously, that this is an impossible thing. You're never going to get to that point.
And I think, as far as we're concerned, the further away you get from nuts and bolts scientific method, the more that starts to apply. I mean, it applies in all formats, but it becomes more important the further you get away from some sort of, you know, repeatability or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. And that's, again, that's why I always am puzzled by anomalists who are looking for objective data. And it's like, that's the point of calling something an anomaly, is it ain't going to happen in a lab. It's not, you know, it's that outlier on the graph. You know, it's that thing that doesn't belong where it is. And we invented statistics to smooth things out like that. And it defies logic to chase after it as if it's not a complete aberration.
Yeah, you throw a hook in the water and you pull something out. It gets out on the land, starts flopping around, but that's not what it is in the water. That's what it is in your context.
Exactly.
And you're only looking at something that flops around. It's like, well, this thing lives in the water. I guess it doesn't do too well out of the water. But you have no idea what it's doing under the water and how it exists there. Really. I mean, it isn't a metaphor, but as you know. But.
Sure.
What's your favorite thing you've written? Your favorite essay,
or
blog entry?
I think My favorite one was I wrote a while back something called Bedtime Stories for Small Extraterrestrials.
I didn't see that one.
It's how little green men went gray. And so I it's all about how my theory on how we at one point we were convinced that aliens were little green men, and somehow that turned into sort of these weird gray sexual predators.
Yeah, I think there have been efforts to try and figure out who first started saying gray aliens, and some of it actually went back to a character in one of my books, Paul, in the Project Beta, Paul Benowitz. They thought he had referred to it somehow first, and they you know, because obviously that spread very quickly with the Whitley Strieber book. Although the one on the cover is not gray, it's kind of like putty colored.
Yeah. But they definitely, like, the heads became larger and the eyes became big and they became very thin and emaciated even. You know, I think there's a lot of eating disorders out there in space. But.
Well, yeah. And well, in this culture, if you go to Albert Rosales's Humanoids site, I can't remember what it's called. It's a catalog of humanoids inciting reports throughout history. And I think the minority is gray aliens.
Yeah, it's a very recent development, and I always like the little green guys too. I mean, Marvin the Martian, you know, he's our sort of prototype for the little green man.
And I think people are also trying to figure out who first said little green man, and it was kind of lost in the mist of history. And I think there are even little green men in the Fantastic Stories stuff from the 30s.
Oh yeah. Well, then you go back and you have the Green Children of Woolpit and all the green people wandering around.
There was a song in the 1950s called "The Little Blue Man."
Oh yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, maybe I'll play it at the end of the show here. But the I typed in "Little Blue Man" I think once into a search engine when I was writing on UFO Mystic. And I found a story of these kids playing in the 1960s, I think, or late 50s, playing on a playground in England on a cloudy day. Or maybe it wasn't at a playground, but it was out in the country. And they said suddenly it was misting, or it suddenly either stopped I think it was a little mist falling. And suddenly it stopped, just stopped, and everything went silent. And there was a little creek near them, and they looked across the creek. And standing across the creek, they saw a, quote, little blue man.
Huh.
Which I thought was fascinating because I'm sure the woman that wrote the song, whoever wrote the song, didn't really. Well, maybe they did hear about that sighting. Who knows?
There are a lot of little blue men in the Celtic. I think it's the Hebrides, the Blue Men of the Minch.
Never heard of them.
A bunch of they're kind of mermaid fairy things that live off the Hebrides, supposedly, and throughout history they're known basically for sinking boats, but they don't sink your boat if you can beat them in poetry usually, but it is early equivalent of a rap battle.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay, that makes sense. You'd have to beat the blue men in a poetry competition?
Pretty much, yeah. And then they don't sink your ship.
We have 3 minutes. Do you want to fill up the 3 minutes with something, or would you like me to play music, or what would you like to do? And also, do what we normally do. What's your site, and is that all you're doing? Do you have other stuff that you want people to know about, or just the blogger site?
That's what I'm doing for now. I'm probably going to be working on I mentioned in the down the rabbit hole, I am actually working on a book. I'm playing with titles. Right now it's Hollow Man, Subterranean Origin of the Species, but we'll see what it turns out to be in the end. I actually just wanted to say thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come on here and talk with you. It's actually been a lot of fun. And the blog is at esoterics.com. That's ESOTERX.com.
Yeah.
And this has been fantastic, and I really appreciate it, Greg.
Oh, well, I appreciate that you actually said yes so quickly. I just called. People don't know. I went to the site, and there was an email address. I wrote to it, and Aaron wrote me back, I think, in like 5 minutes. And I wrote him back. And when he wrote me back, he gave me his phone number. And I thought, should I call him right away? So I said, can I call you? And we talked for about 20 minutes and found out we kind of had a lot of the same background and interests, even though his is far more technical than mine. I'm doing video stuff, but he's not technical, but academic. And I thought, well, why not just ask him if he wants to come on the show? And he said yes. And I'm very thankful you did. And at some point, you know you're going to have to come back because we're never going to finish this conversation. And that's what it's all about.
Always happy to.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You have a good evening.
You too. And I'll play Little Blue Man here, and I'll post this in the next few days, and you can hear it. I think you can probably find it on YouTube, but whatever. I always liked that song. Kind of freaked me out when I was a kid. It actually kind of scared me.
It is a little bit on the creepy side.
It is creepy. I mean, it's supposed to be silly and satiric, but it's kind of creepy. Anyway, okay. Thanks so much, Aaron, and thanks for staying up over there in the Eastern time zone to talk to me for so late.
No problem. Really enjoyed it. You take care.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Well, let me find Little Blue Man here. I got a couple of nice comments from people during the show saying they're enjoying it, which is good because I did too, a lot. What's amazing is that at this point in history, I can just find somebody who's doing something that I think is interesting. And like I said, Bruce Duensing pointed it out to me. And it's kind of like when we had Excluded Middle. Nobody ever refused to be interviewed. I think I've had one person refuse to be interviewed just because they were shy. Red Pill did when he at the beginning. He said, my English isn't good. But then he got over that. I think Micah Hanks and some few podcasters he knew helped him with that. And much to everybody's eternal enrichment, he said yes. And the same thing here with Aaron. I'm so glad he could come on and just talk about what we were interested in. Thanks for being patient, and thanks for listening tonight, and thank you so much, Aaron.
One morning when I was out shopping, though you'll find it hard to believe, a little blue man came out of the crowd and timidly tugged at my sleeve.
I love you, I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. I hurried back to my apartment. I rushed in and I closed the door. But there on the desk stood the little blue man who started to tell me once more.
I love you, I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. 4 weeks after that I was haunted, though no one could see him but me. Right by my side was the little blue man, wherever I happened to be.
I love you.
One evening in wild desperation, I rushed to a rooftop in town, and over the side pushed the little blue man, who sang to me all the way down.
I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. I whispered, thank goodness that's over. I smiled as I hurried outside. But there on the street stood the little blue man, who said with a tear in his eye,
I don't love you anymore.